Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Same ballots that they were toting in there. Because they just, there was just such a complete breakdown in that chain of custody. There's an interesting thing along those lines that I would have loved to see in New Hampshire. In Alameda County, California, they're going to be putting tracking devices in with the...
You're listening to WNJC, 1360 AM in Washington Township, New Jersey. For the last hour, you're listening to Voice of the Voters. Check them out, voiceofthevoters.org. Up next, we have Rob Call, Bottom Up Radio Show.
And here it is, the Rob Call Bottom Up Radio Show. And we've got a great show tonight. We also have amazing competition tonight. We've got the Phillies game for our local listeners. If the Phillies win tonight, they go on to the World Series. And then we have a little thing, the last debate, the last presidential debate. So the good thing is that I have a feeling that a lot of people are going to be able to listen to this on download. And I hope so, because we've got a great show lined up. We've got Naomi Klein coming on, and I'm really excited. I think she's one of the smartest people on the planet, frankly. What she's put together with her book, The Shock Doctrine, is simply brilliant. She has diagnosed a disease that has afflicted humanity and this planet in a way that has really pissed off a lot of economists and a lot of leaders and a lot of business people. When you get such information, when you get the number of the beast, it's a very powerful thing. And she's done it. And I'm going to wait till she's on, which will be a little while, before we actually talk about get to the description of what the shock doctrine is. But her book is Shock Doctrine. This is the subtitle, Disaster Capitalism. I'm going to talk a little bit about the article I wrote today. It's titled Big Bankers Blink, Paulson's Unprecedented Power, Shock and Awe, Hints at the Good and Evil We May Soon Face. I'm going to try to switch the line I'm on here because I'm getting a little static. Okay, good. We're still, that sounds like that might be better. So, Big Bankers Blink, Paulson's Unprecedented Power. The Wall Street Journal reported this morning that on Monday, Henry Paulson summoned the heads of the nation's biggest banks to meet with him. He put them at a table. He and Ben Bernanke spent an hour telling them how bad things were, how bad they were going to get, and they handed them each a document that said, this is what we're going to do. This is what you're going to agree to. And the document basically said that the U.S. government was going to buy a chunk of preferred stock in each of these huge banks. And they all agreed. So all of a sudden, the banking industry is partially owned by the U.S. government. Now, I have in front of me a book I picked up a couple weeks ago, printed in 1857. And it has in it the Democratic Party platform. One of the first things that it states in that 1857 platform was one of the worst things that could be done for America is for the government to create or own or run or have a piece of a bank. So, not exactly the idea of the earlier leaders of the country or the Democratic Party. Now, I look at this and I see an incredible power. The fact that the Treasury Secretary, an appointee of the president, can call in the heads of some of the biggest, most powerful companies on the planet and say, this is what you're going to do, and they say, yes, sir, means a couple things. One thing it means is an enormous amount of power. The other thing it probably means, and the readers pointed this out to me, really, is they're probably happy to do it. It's probably something that they wanted to do. And I'm going to ask Naomi Klein about this and where it all fits in. But this is a lot of power, and it just gives us a hint of what can be done. It gives us a hint of the power that George Bush has, that he can wield, that he can exert in the few months left where he is presiding over the worst presidency in the history of the United States. It's an awful lot of threat that he can do an enormous amount of damage. Now, maybe there's a promise as well that the next president, if that's Obama, can do some good things. Now, I get the impression that McCain will continue to do the same kind of things that Bush did, except that McCain, at least Bush went to Yale. You know, at least he went to Yale, he got B's and C's. McCain would have been thrown out of the Naval Academy if his father and his grandfather hadn't been admirals. McCain doesn't pay attention. McCain's even less interested than Bush. I'm afraid that nobody's asked McCain what newspapers he reads. At least Sarah Palin came up with an excuse after a while, or an answer. McCain is a frightening guy. And we'll ask Naomi Klein about him, too. We're waiting. She's going to come on in a couple minutes. And we're going to get about a half an hour with her. So things are looking very good for Obama. And if you're someone who has not been happy with the last 8 years, then that's probably a good thing. If you've been happy with the last 8 years, then you're probably not happy with the last couple weeks because you probably have lost a lot of money. I wrote a piece on Sunday that a mailer went out last week and this week that was the most powerful mailer for the campaign. That mailer was a report on the quarterly condition of people's 401ks, mutual funds, IRAs. Probably between 50 and 100 million people got those mailers reporting on how their savings, their life savings, their retirement savings, their children's educational funds, how those had fared in the last quarter. Personally, mine dropped about 30%. Wasn't happy. Now, I just got another one today. Wasn't quite as bad. It was about 25%. So they're still coming in. But I think that these mailers have had a huge influence upon why the polls are turning so drastically. It's not about Sarah Palin. It's not about talking about the former weatherman by the name of Ayers. It's not about the nasty attacks that McCain is doing, although that may have a little effect. It's all about these mailers. People are getting shocked.
Hear me here.
Oh, great. And I just used the word shocked. Great to have you here so much. I was just talking about how Hank Paulson pulled together the leaders of the top banks in the country on Monday and basically sat them down, told them how bad things were, handed them a document that said, this is what you're going to agree to. Did you see that article in the Wall Street Journal?
I saw the article, but I think the way this is being spun is a little absurd.
Tell me about it.
Well, I mean, the spin is that Paulson was really tough with the banks and forced them to sign against their will. I mean, the terms of this deal are incredibly favorable to the banks. They didn't have to negotiate because they couldn't have negotiated a better deal for themselves. They get the money, but the government is taking no power. There's no voting rights. So they've just been handed free money in the midst of an economic crisis. A lot of these banks, if they aren't bailed out, they're going down. So this spin that Henry Paulson is so tough with the banks is absurd. He's the best thing that's ever happened to them, and he's one of them.
Now, Ben Bernanke studied the Depression, and during the Depression they did something like this, but the government did have control. Isn't that right?
Exactly. And, I mean, even if we just compare what Paulson did to what Gordon Brown did, just on the straight level of what taxpayers are going to get paid back, Gordon Brown, I think British taxpayers are getting 12%, and American taxpayers are getting 5%.
Ooh.
Yeah, they could have gotten
them. Nice.
Much better deal, so no wonder the banks agreed to it so quickly.
Well, you know, I'd love to hear more about what you've been observing and what's been going on the last couple weeks with the bailout and the consolidation of the leading of all these banks into fewer and fewer.
Yeah. Well, it's been a really interesting few weeks. I think that people need to take all this media reporting with a great deal of skepticism. You know, one of the things, one of the real lessons, I think, of this period, and, you know, this is a period of shock, as you know, and this is one of these moments where things start moving into fast forward. There's so much that happens in a week, you can't even
Well, let's just take one moment. You know, I introduced you before you got on, because I didn't want to waste any time, but you've written a book, The Shock Doctrine, Disaster Capitalism. Can you give, like, just a few minutes to this, like, a quick overview of what it is and how that fits into what we'll be talking about?
Yeah, well, the thesis of the book is that if we want to understand how this radical market fundamentalism has swept the globe, the system that has imploded before our eyes, a deregulated system that is so profitable for the people at the top, but something of a disaster for everyone else. If we want to understand how this system swept the globe from Latin America to Russia to this country, we need to understand the incredible utility of crisis to this project, because the great leaps forward for this project have taken place in the midst or in the immediate aftermath of some kind of a shock. And the extreme cases that I discuss in the book are wars, terrorist attacks, natural disasters, but overwhelmingly the most common shock that has created the context for pushing through these very unpopular policies in a way that economists often call economic shock therapy. So the first shock is the crisis, the second shock is the economic shock therapy. Overwhelmingly, the shocks have been economic crises, whether it's the Asian financial crisis in 1997 or the economic crisis in the former Soviet Union that created the sort of panic atmosphere where they could impose economic shock therapy. So, you know, we are in one of those moments of shock. And in the book, I quote a Polish human rights activist in 1989, describing what it was like in that country when they were living through a very profound economic crisis, and they became the first Eastern Bloc country to be prescribed shock therapy. And she said, "We're living in dog years, not human years," which is to say just this fast-forward, intense period where you can barely keep up. And I think we are living in dog years at the moment.
You know, it's one thing that shocked me. I got to ask you this. Ever since I read Sinclair Lewis's book, It Can't Happen Here. Have you read that?
Yeah.
It's fascinated me, and I followed how we've been moving in that direction.
Yeah.
Well, recently I got a first edition with the dust jacket, and it's very similar to the cover to your book. Are you aware of that?
I had no idea.
I'm going to send you a picture of it. It'll blow your mind.
Great.
Because it's in many ways, the shock doctrine recaps what happened. It can easily, it's happened. That's what happens. It can't happen here. Right?
Yeah, and, you know, and I think that one of the things that just coming back to the beginning of our discussion, thinking about what we've gone through in the past few weeks, is that this tactic of using a crisis to push through very unpopular policies really relies on people not knowing about it. It's a tactic that is about harnessing the state of panic, the state of disorientation, even the regression that takes place in a crisis. But there's a kind of law of diminishing return on this particular tactic, because once we've identified it, then we engage in a kind of a pattern recognition when it gets reused. So one of the lessons that I think is really important to focus on, if we think about the original bailout, the plan, the Paulson plan, that 2.5-page extraordinary document that Hank Paulson came up with, giving him absolute power, shielding this plan to buy $700 billion of toxic debts from challenge from any arm of government or any court. There was a real popular uprising against that plan, and people just didn't buy it, despite the fact that the big corporate media was selling it really, really hard, like saying, you know, we're all going to die unless we get this plan, and this isn't a bailout for Wall Street, it's a bailout for you, and it's the only option, and there was, you know, bipartisan support for this thing, and both candidates signed on to it, and Congress voted against it, and they voted, if Congress voted against it, this is the originally, right, we know they voted for it eventually, because Congress people were being bombarded with calls from their constituents saying that they didn't want to bail out Wall Street, that they didn't believe that this plan would help, that they didn't believe it would benefit them. And we know that the Congress people who were in the tightest races were more inclined to vote against the plan. So it was an outbreak of real democracy in the United States. And after that, people were really scolded, right, for their ignorance, for having turned away from this bailout that would have saved them, and eventually the Senate approved it, and then Congress approved it with some amendments. But I think what's important about where we are now is that we see that the people were right, despite the fact that they were hearing from everybody how wrong they were. That original assessment that this deal stank, that there was something wrong with it, was the right one. And more than that, I think that people really identified the patterns. They remembered what happened after 9/11. They remembered the way they were sold lies in the lead up to the war in Iraq. So I think people are becoming more shock resistant. But unfortunately, the political leadership is really doing everything they can to resist that.
Well, yes, and that is the problem, isn't it? Now, do you think they get this? As soon as this broke, the first thing I did was talk about how this was another example of selling WMDs, throwing WMDs up as a way to scare everybody.
Yeah.
But
in this case, they really are WMDs, right? I mean, these toxic debts are often described by economists as like sticks of dynamite in these financial institutions, or you know, they really are bombs that Henry Paulson is voluntarily taking from the private sector and bringing to Washington so they can explode the federal budget, and it may well save the banks, and it may well bankrupt the country. I mean, these are the stakes, and you know, at a certain point, the question is, you know, them or us.
And it seems like they're not finished doing the damage yet. It's still, after a day like today, we can expect a lot more roller coaster rides going down, down, further and further.
Well, first of all, there is one good thing that came out of the wrangling and the negotiations, which is a clause that gave Henry Paulson the ability, though it didn't mandate him, the ability to buy equity in the banks. And now that clause is being invoked. They are not abandoning, and this is very important for people to understand, they are not abandoning the original terrible plan of buying up the toxic debt. They're just doing both, okay? They're contracting out the job of buying up the toxic debt to the same banks that are applying for the bailout. And, you know, the levels of conflict of interest, I've been looking at the contracts and who they're being handed out to. I mean, it just makes your hair fall out. It's just, it's the shamelessness is unbelievable. The law firm that has been given the contract to advise the government on the equity buyouts is the law firm for 7 of the 9 banks. Okay.
Oh my God.
So I mean, that
total conflict of interest.
Right, but I mean, I guess it's hard to top Henry Paulson himself, right? As you know, known as Mr. Risk when he was CEO of Goldman Sachs, was one of the inventors of this field of very complex mortgage-backed securities, and you know, he took Goldman Sachs' debt from $20 billion in 1999 to $100 billion in 2005. So he's one of the people who put those explosives in the bank, and now he's taking the explosives off their hands. So I guess once you've accepted that level of conflict of interest, the rest is minor.
What do you think of Paulson's appointee, this Neil Kashkari? Any ideas about him?
Well, I mean, he's also from Goldman Sachs, and he's very inexperienced. He got his MBA 6 years ago. He was certainly a favorite at Goldman Sachs. He was paid $700,000 in his final year. And, you know, I think what worries me about him is that, you know, he comes out of that world and he's going back to that world, right? I mean, this is a very short-term job for him. It's a political appointment and he will be out of there,
in a couple months.
And I think that really does raise the question of where his interests lie. I mean, they're saying over and over again we are only interested in what's good for taxpayers. But as I said, you know, Gordon Brown got a deal for British taxpayers that is more than twice as good. And
I haven't heard that reported anywhere.
You know where I read it? The Financial Times. Okay, so in an editorial in the Financial Times today, they remarked on that. But the point is that, you know, there is still an election. Politicians are still open to pressure. The candidates are still open to pressure. So they have taken a step in the right direction in going for equity. But the deal has to be much better, and there has to be power as well as risk that is transferred to the taxpayer. So people need to stay engaged in this debate because, as you say, this crisis isn't ending, and the stakes couldn't be higher. Anyone who cares about the promises that Barack Obama is making and his ability to make good on those promises has to care about whether the Bush administration is currently in the process of bankrupting the next administration. Because all, you know, the people who are selling this plan right now will go back to their think tanks after the elections, if Barack Obama wins. And then say, and this is interesting, you know, Henry Paulson in a statement yesterday started talking about the financial crisis and needing to reexamine entitlements. That's code for Social Security, Medicaid, right? I mean, they're already getting ready to go after what they call the entitlement programs, which I find amazing. Even that phrase, entitlement programs, after seeing the sense of entitlement from the financial industry, is pretty amazing. But they will use the crisis that they themselves have created and they themselves have deepened as a rationale for saying everything Barack Obama is saying, yes, we can, about to say, no, you can't. We can't afford it. We're in the midst of a financial crisis.
Now, what you said earlier about dog years, about how things were accelerated, they are sped up. People are used to calling their legislators once a month, something like that. The way things are going, they've got to be calling them every couple of days, really, it sounds like. Absolutely.
And I'll tell you something. I've heard from people in the Obama campaign that the day after Barack Obama voted for the bailout, he got more negative calls than he'd gotten the entire campaign.
He should have. He deserved them.
Yeah. But listen, you know, this is all connected. And in terms of, you know, what the stakes are, these banks were going down. Okay, these banks were going bankrupt because of their own deeds. And the bankers themselves, as we know, have golden parachutes and bonuses and so on. But it is possible to get so much of a better deal than the one that has been quote-unquote negotiated by Henry Paulson and Neil Kashkari of Goldman Sachs, okay? And the point of negotiating that deal is that these banks that have failed in the private sector eventually are having to move into the public sector. They are being nationalized. But the question is it going to be a good enough deal that they will actually be serious revenue generators? Because this could end up being a backwards opportunity. Being in a financial crisis and actually having a new revenue stream, a significant new revenue stream, which are the banks, you know, who frankly, you know, if they're well managed, can be a serious source of revenue, could be the way that Barack Obama could pay for the promises that he is making now. You know, and I realize that that sounds like something radical to say, nationalize the banks and use the revenue to pay for your services. But I don't think that's more radical than what they're doing now. You know, they're doing socialism for the rich. And I say if they're going to be nationalizing the banks, nationalize them in the interest of everyone. Nationalize them in a way that will make this country be able to afford a real green energy infrastructure. Nationalize them in a way that will allow the United States to provide health care to every person in the country. You know, that is actually what people should be demanding in this moment of dog years when things are moving so quickly and suddenly we don't know what's possible. Think big.
So you cite Milton Friedman, who was the father of this idea, kind of like Hitler was the father of Nazism. And I'm saying that, not you. I don't want to stick that in your mouth. But you spoke recently at the University of Chicago, and you cited a quote that you say you use frequently with him. Friedman said, only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around.
Mm-hmm.
That, I believe, is our basic function, to develop alternatives to existing policies, to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable. Now, we need to be able to be ready with those ideas,
okay,
like you just described. And does anybody have them? I mean, you noted it in your talk that you've been observing and collecting these Friedman-type lying-around ideas. Does the left have lying-around ideas that they can plug in during this crisis?
Well, I think
and
that,
step
yeah.
all over Paulson?
Well, I think that we do have those ideas, and what we lack more than ideas is confidence in those ideas and believing that they really are good ideas.
And to promote them.
The confidence to promote them, especially in a crisis. When they're needed most, right, on the verge of recession, really believe in that green infrastructure, you know, green-collar economy that Van Jones is talking about, and use this moment to make it happen. Believe that you spend your way out of a recession, and believe that the global climate crisis is a bigger crisis than what's going on Wall Street. And that we cannot allow Wall Street's crisis to cancel out our ability to take away our tools to meet the most pressing crisis of our time, which is global warming.
Mm-hmm.
We need to stay focused, and you know, I believe that sort of confidence in this moment opens up tremendous possibilities. You know, if you can bail out AIG, an insurance company, which has now received more than $100 billion, right? That could get health care to every child in the country. And it's time to, you know, seize this moment because if we don't seize this moment to make those types of arguments about what's possible, right, and understand the stakes of actually negotiating a good deal with these banks, right? I mean, I think the banks should be allowed to go bankrupt and they should be taken over by the state on the most favorable terms possible. And then they become the revenue generation stream. Rather than a sap on public resources that prevent us from meeting the climate crisis, from meeting healthcare crisis, and all of the other challenges before us. So this can be flipped into an opportunity, but only if there is tremendous confidence in our ideas. I don't think it's about not having the ideas. I really think the left panics in a crisis, okay? And we regress and we start projecting far more, competence and goodwill onto people in the Bush administration than they deserve. I don't think that Henry Paulson has gotten nearly a rough enough ride. We're seeing this now from Barney Frank. He's looking at these contracts and giving his seal of approval to the conflicts of interest. It's outrageous.
Barney Frank represents all the bankers and all the investors in Connecticut. He's doing his job. They're his constituents, unfortunately, for the rest of us.
Well, for the few weeks until the election, politicians can't afford to ignore their other constituents, you know, and it gets harder after an election. And there's another point that I want to make, you know, to Obama's supporters out there, which is, you know, he is saying some really important things on the campaign trail about this really being a referendum on an ideology, the ideology of deregulation and trickle-down economics. And that's exactly the right message. What worries me is that he's taking top-level economic advice from Bob Rubin and Larry Summers, both of whom are responsible, along with Alan Greenspan and Phil Graham, for the disaster that we're living through right now. And I say that, you know, directly responsible. These are the people who refused to regulate derivatives, who fought off all attempts and sage advice saying that they should do so. There was a fantastic piece in the New York Times recently re-examining Alan Greenspan's legacy. I'm sure you saw it, right? But what was really remarkable about that piece is that the two other people who really shared responsibility were Robert Rubin and Larry Summers. And what we know about Robert Rubin is that when he was at Goldman Sachs, and after Bill Clinton won the election in 1992, he started having meetings with Clinton. This is after the election, but before inauguration. And in that key period, he convinced Clinton that he should abandon many of his promises from the campaign trail and embrace economic austerity. Okay? We need to get Rubin away from Obama. He should be as much of a political liability as Reverend Wright, because he is one of the people who created this disaster.
Who should Obama be listening to? Who are the good guys?
Who are the good guys? Well, Joseph Stiglitz is a good guy, and he is listening to Joseph Stiglitz. But you know what we need to understand, right, is that he's going to be picking his Treasury Secretary. He's going to be picking his trade representative. He's going to be deciding who is going to replace Neil Kashkari in terms of managing that $700 billion bailout. And we need to make sure that it isn't Rubin's protege, Jason Furman, who Obama appointed as an economic advisor, who is a believer in Rubinomics and thinks Walmart is great for poor people. It should be people like Stiglitz. It should be people like Paul Krugman, Dean Baker, Jared Bernstein. If he really believes that this is the that this is about abandoning these policies of deregulation, he needs to get away from Bob Rubin and Larry Summers.
How bad would things be?
One of the things that I think people should say at this point to Obama is that the next Treasury Secretary shouldn't come from Wall Street.
Amen. I need to just do a quick station ID. This is the Rob Kalsh Bottom-Up Show, WNJC 1360, and I'm talking to Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, and by my reckoning, one of the smartest women in the world. And I'm loving this conversation. Now, what can we do to get rid of Rubin and his ilk from the Obama administration? Before it starts.
Well, we tell Obama that we agree with what he's saying, but that we understand the game he's playing. Okay, when he says this is the end of this ethos of trickle down economics and deregulation, and then he has his picture taken next to Bob Rubin and Larry Summers and Paul Volcker. You know what he's doing? He's winking at Wall Street, and he's saying, "Don't listen to what I'm saying, you know, to get elected." There's going to be economic continuity, as the economists call it, this is the game, right? And
this is why a lot of our readers don't trust Obama and are not going to vote for him. Actually,
you know what?
Op-ed news.
I don't think this is about whether or not you vote for Obama. This is about whether we understand the game. Okay, that's the game he's playing, and we also know that he's vulnerable to political pressure, and we need to make Rubin and Furman and Summers political liabilities for him. We need to take him at his word. If he really wants to put this ideology on trial, then that includes people within the Democratic Party who created this disaster. I mean, so many of the policies that really directly created this disaster were introduced in the late 90s under Clinton. Okay, and it really doesn't serve anyone to see this through a partisan lens. It was the killing of Glass-Steagall that put up a firewall between investment banks and consumer banks, and it was the decision not to regulate derivatives. And those things happened in 99.
Now, we've got about 10 minutes left based on the time frame you've given me. There are two things I want to talk about yet. One, I call the show the Bottom-Up Show because bottom-up is the future of government, of democracy, of elections. In the last couple of weeks, Bill Clinton and Obama have mentioned it. Could you kind of plug in some of your ideas into the bottom-up versus top-down way of looking at things? And then the other thing I want to talk about is McCain and his and how he'll approach this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is why I say it's not about who you vote for or who you trust. It's about being a political adult and realizing that political change isn't handed down from above. It's demanded from below. And if we don't, you know, what I've been saying to people is, look, Obama's a centrist. He's never lied about this. This is who he is through and through. He will find the center of wherever that debate is. But the good part about Obama is that if the center moves, he'll move with it. And we've seen that during this economic crisis, right, where the center has moved, the base has gotten more and more radical, more and more angry at Wall Street, and Obama has reflected that anger back to people, right? So what I've been saying to people is, if you don't like where Obama is, move the center. Move the center. Go out there and say some really radical things and fight for them and organize. Move the center, because that's how America got the New Deal. Not because FDR handed it down from above, but because people were organizing in trade unions, in neighborhood groups. They were preventing their neighbors from being evicted from their homes by moving their furniture back into their homes. That's how things like rent control were won. That's how that's why Fannie Mae was created in the first place, to prevent foreclosures. That's how Social Security was won. It was in that interplay between a very, very mobilized, radicalized base and a politician who was willing to listen. But more importantly, FDR was able to sell the New Deal as a compromise, because people were so radical that he was able to say to the elites, look, we're on the verge of revolution. We're on the verge of socialism. We need to give them something. And the New Deal, as we know, wasn't just one policy. They had to deepen it and sweeten the pot more and more, because people were so radical. That's the kind of spirit that we need to return to. And so it isn't about, bashing Obama or, complaining about Obama or distrusting Obama. It's about being that, credible threat from below.
So what do we need to ask for that they can compromise to?
You just heard me call for the full nationalization of the banks. I've also been calling for the nationalization of Exxon. When people say, we won't be able to afford the green energy plan. The biggest corporate criminals of them all are not the banks. They're the oil and gas companies. They've externalized their risk, which is climate change. You've got a company like Exxon, which earned $40 billion in profits alone last year. I don't accept the fact that while oil companies are earning that level of profit, that we're going to be told that we can't afford the investments in alternative energy and regulation that are necessary to address the most pressing crisis of our time. So, I've said this on national television. I'm going to keep saying it. I think that creates a space for a pretty deep windfall profit tax on the oil companies. It puts the discussion, I think, in the direction where it should be. But, I think that there's often a feeling on the left in the United States, or people are told that they're a liability if they take too radical a position. And there's always this idea that you just sort of support the candidate until after the election. But then after the election, the candidate's going to be, under a huge amount of attack from the right. So then you have to support them against that. And so there's really never a moment of intellectual honesty. I think this is a real test. I wish Move On would use their incredible network to say, we don't want Bob Rubin, and really stand up for homeowners. The networks are there, but there's a real unwillingness to take those risks.
What else can we do? We can privatize Exxon. What else? What other ideas?
Nationalize Exxon.
What else can activists do? What else can the grassroots start doing now, immediately, to help move the Congress, move Obama to a better place that's going to prevent the disaster capitalism from running rampant over us?
Well, there, like I said, you know, there is this window now where the terms of the bailout are being discussed, and it's a really, really important window, and unfortunately, it's also the most important window for the election. So everybody, you know, who's an Obama supporter is focused on, you know, getting out the vote and this final push, and meanwhile, the terms of the bailout are being negotiated, and this is going to radically affect the room that Obama has to maneuver. So there has to be some time spared for putting political pressure on that negotiation. And one key demand is that now that they have moved partially to these nationalizations as opposed to buying the toxic debts, the real issue is how much of the money is going to be spent on the toxic debts versus this other route. And, you know, we really need to minimize the amount that's spent on these toxic debts, because this is just a bad plan, a discredited plan that the Bush administration, with their usual stubbornness, won't let go.
So we've got people who want to do something. They're going to take time out from doing canvassing and phone banking. They're going to call their legislators. What are they going to tell them? What should they say?
They're
going to
say,
next phone calls?
Abandon the original plan completely. You know, this is at this point, this is just pride and cronyism that it's still alive. Every economist, even the conservative Wall Street Journal and FT editorial pages have said that the equity plan is a far better plan than the toxic debts. Now, why are they spending hundreds of billions of dollars buying these toxic debts still? They should abandon that plan, along with the crony contracts that they're handing out to administer that plan.
Okay. Now, the last thing I want to wrap with you on is I want to talk a little bit about John McCain and his approach to economics. What you said at the Chicago School was that his inexperience plays into the Friedman shock doctrine economic approach. Talk a little bit about McCain and Palin and where you see them going with economic approaches.
Well, look, I mean, we've been talking about what the right strategy would be if Obama wins, and one way I think that we can think about this economic crisis is that it's sort of Republicans buying insurance against an Obama presidency, and so that they're able to say, no, you can't, about all the things he's saying, yes, we can. Now, they don't need insurance against a McCain presidency, because it's in McCain's platform that he wants to privatize Social Security. He's already saying that he's going to freeze spending. He's already saying that he's going to look at every single government program, and if it isn't working, either reform it or shut it down. So he's really talking about a shock therapy program after he's elected. And, you know, I think if he is elected, which is a terrifying prospect, I think he really will do it, because he, you know, there is unfinished business from the Bush years. Most notably for the privatization of Social Security.
You've gotten one of those Clinton words, it. What is it that he will do? You said he will really do it.
Do it. That he really will eliminate all kinds of important programs and really will privatize Social Security, because there is a window of opportunity after an election win where a politician has a mandate and they're able to do things very, very quickly, particularly if they can appeal to an economic crisis. So I think that's precisely what they would do. And, you know, I guess what I said at the University of Chicago is that the appeal of this free market ideology, the Friedmanite free market ideology, is that it says to politicians who are in over their heads when it comes to economics that actually all they need to do is get out of the way and let the market work its magic. Right. So, you know, the fact that McCain admits that he doesn't know anything about the economy and went ahead and chose a running mate who knows even less, actually makes him much more inclined to embracing this, you know, very simple. It's really not an ideology. It's a series of talking points. You know, the government is a problem, not the solution, and so on. So basically, it's an abdication of his responsibility to govern. And I think that's why this ideology has carried so much appeal for, you know, not to be too snide, but, you know, film actor presidents and bodybuilder governors and so on.
Well, McCain also has Phil Graham to appoint as the Treasury Secretary, right?
Yeah, and Phil Graham made it his mission to get the to get a Medal of Honor for Milton Friedman before he died. He's very much a believer in this ideology, but I don't think it's, you know, for guys like him that it's really the ideology that drives it. I mean, this is an ideology that is a gift to business. So, you know, what's driving it, right? Is it that this is an incredible way to keep your donors happy and, you know, keep yourself in power, or because you really believe this is the best way to organize society? I mean, the beauty of the free market ideology is that you don't have to choose between self-interest and true belief. They're the same thing.
Amazing. Naomi Klein, author of Shock Doctrine. You said you had to go. Do you have any time left, or is it time to leave?
Unfortunately, I have to go, yeah, but it was great talking with you.
It's been great. One last question. When I asked you about coming on, if you knew Op-Ed News, you said, of course.
Yeah.
Have any comment on Op-Ed News?
I think you guys are fantastic, and yeah, I read you all the time, and I appreciate the nonpartisan nature of it, and it's going to be more and more important. To have real critical alternative voices that aren't lined up behind a candidate.
Thank you so much.
Thank
it's
you.
It's been a pleasure. I hope we can do it again.
Absolutely. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
So, Naomi Klein, and telling us that we got to get on Obama, telling us that we need to be calling a lot more than we're used to because things have sped up. We're in dog years, and a lot of people are telling us it's going to get worse. And now it's a good time for some phone-ins. So let's get some phone numbers here. This is going to take me a minute, but I'm going to give you some phone numbers to call in on, and maybe we can get some folks to discuss this. Oh, boy. I don't have it handy. I got to dig it up. Just going to take a second. This is Rob Cole, the Bottom Up Show, 1360 AM, WNJC. And you want to call in on... I'm going to give a couple numbers, and my producer is going to correct me if I'm wrong. 856-232-7077, 856-232-7078. Those are the two main numbers, 856-232-7077, 856-232-7078. It's the Rob Call Show. We just finished talking with Naomi Klein, and I got to tell you, over the years, I've run conferences for brain surgeons and brain researchers, NASA engineers. I'm impressed. This Naomi Klein is 38 years old. I checked Wikipedia, and I swear she's one of the smartest people I've ever met, and I've met some geniuses. Boy, I'm impressed. I'm acting silly, I think, but she's something else. What this tells me is this is all a big plan, and it's all going perfectly according to plans. This is something that didn't just accidentally happen. It happened because it was envisioned, because there were theories and they were put into place. And now we're going through the shock. We're going through the disaster that was envisioned by Milton Friedman and the Chicago School of Economics. Let me repeat that again, the Chicago School of Economics. Now, the University of Chicago is an incredible institution. The Chicago School of Economics is part of the University of Chicago. The Chicago School of Economics is an evil place. It is an evil organization that has perpetrated acts throughout the world that have led to many deaths, many tortures, much suffering, attacks upon and destruction of democracy, the ends of unions. This is what Naomi Klein writes about in her book. This is the Chicago School of Economics. She was speaking there because it had recently just established an institute there. I'm not sure if it's an institute. It's a $200 million it's funded with. This is to promote Friedman's policies, Milton Friedman. These are the policies of the shock doctrine. These are the now. What Naomi Klein didn't talk about was she starts her book off talking about torture. It's not exactly torture. She actually starts off talking about research that was done in Montreal at McGill University by a psychiatrist where he drugged people. He put them into sensory deprivation where they couldn't move, they couldn't feel. They would have, like, outfits on that would prevent them from feeling anything but the felt on the inside the outfit. They would be kept in the dark. They would be disoriented and drugged. And what they learned from this was they could get people to do almost anything, to believe almost anything, to agree to everything. And they figured this out, that this was a nice way to work with prisoners, to get them to cooperate. So they transferred the concepts to torture. And hello, that's my other line was going. They transferred the concept to torture, and the U.S. took this idea, this shock doctrine, where you shock somebody by disorienting them, by getting them so they can't tell what's going on around them, and they applied it to capturing and interrogating prisoners. So now, if you're going to capture a prisoner, you do it in the middle of the night while they're half asleep, put a bag over their head, maybe drug them up, take them away, and then keep them confused and disoriented for weeks and months. And after a while, they start cooperating. Of course, who knows what you get? Who knows how tainted the information is? But this was the idea of the shock doctrine for torture. This was a way to get docile, cooperative prisoners. Well, Friedman took the idea and applied it to economics. And that's where his idea that the opportunities come in during crisis. I'll read his line again. Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. So when you have stuff lying around ready to throw in, that you can make the changes. Friedman had his ideas of the shock doctrine laying around. What are the ideas that progressives and liberals have lying around? What are ideas that people who believe in democracy and equal justice for all and a healthy environment, what laying around ideas do they have? Because we should have them. We should have them inscribed in stone. And there are a lot of ideas that we have values for. We want a healthy environment. We want equal treatment for everyone. We want health care for everyone, just like the rest of the developed world has. Why don't we have it? Because we can't afford it. Hey, we can suddenly afford $700 billion to bail out, and it's bailing out. It's still bailing them out. You can call it investing in them. You can call it saving these loans. It's bailing them out, these companies that were profligate, that gambled, that engaged in highly risky behavior that failed. And now, what are we doing? We're facing a situation where the average American has lost $30,000, $40,000 in savings. $9 trillion disappeared. $9 trillion disappeared from the stock market since the beginning of the year. This is Rob Call, Bottom Up Radio. Hi, Jay. Where are you from?
Hello.
Where are you from, Jay?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Where are you from?
Texas. I'm one of your editors, Rob. This is Jay Farrington.
Oh, hi, Jay. Good to have you.
Thank you.
What's your question or comment?
Well, you know me, I forgot it while I was trying to get called in, but there's plenty of others.
What does Naomi say,
do you think, to the bottom-up thing about economics, including, I think, you know, you had a program where a man said if a corporation is too big to fail, it's too big?
That's Senator Bernie Sanders, that's right.
Yes, yes.
And they're trying to... What Naomi Klein said in her talk to the University of Chicago was they're trying to make them that big. It's
right.
An intentional thing that they're making them so big. They're merging them together so they're so big that they can't fail.
It's like it was in back in the day, the robber barons, Tammany Ring and all that. The antitrust movement. Here's my question.
What movement?
Is there a possibility that our economy could go the other way, like Schumacher, small is beautiful, to decentralize? Isn't centralization one of the big problems?
I agree. I think this is the bottom-up approach that Bill Clinton and Obama talked about. That, you know, I've been writing about it. We're not going to have a stronger, healthier economy by consolidating all the banking energy, all the banking resources into a handful of companies. You know, Japan has three banks. That's it. We've got to do the opposite. We should be investing in 10,000 banks and helping all the ones that did well, not all these incompetent failure banks. We should be rewarding the banks that did a good job, that didn't get in trouble. And we should go to them and say, show us your bottom line. The better you've done, the more we'll invest in you. And we should let them manage these failed banks, these giant banks, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and Bank of America and Western Union, they're all in trouble. They're all in big trouble. Why? Because they took risks that they shouldn't have taken. Because they approached the economy with exotic derivatives and all kinds of crazy stuff built on top of theories and constructs instead of just basic business.
Hey, one more question, Rob, and then I'll get off. The question is, now that we've found out that Congress doesn't have to listen to the will of the people very clearly during this crisis, they went ahead and did what they were told by someone. What is the people's recourse now? Now what? Wait for the election and hope that make things different? Still there?
I've been thinking a lot about this.
Still bottom up.
There are a lot of people on opednews.com that say the answer is to vote for a third-party candidate, to don't vote at all. I really believe that you got to make a choice among the two primary candidates now, and then we got to do everything we can to get rid of the ones who didn't do their job or over the next 2 years don't come around. I think, you know, we've been told that there were threats of that there would be a military takeover if this didn't go through, this $700 billion bailout. I don't doubt that there were that people were told that.
If that's true, those same people obviously still are not going to come forward and say, I was threatened there. In fact, it would probably be just that we just had a conversation, that's all. You know.
Yeah.
But they know they were threatened, and it's gotten out, but is there anybody that's standing up and saying that publicly?
Well, one or two. From what I understand, you know, I spoke with my congressman over the weekend, you know, and he said that he was not happy with the way things were originally, even though he voted for it the first time around. But the second time he said he felt better because it did have some protections in there and what have you. But Naomi Klein just made it really clear that what's been passed so far is no good and needs to be fixed. I can't believe that in England, Gordon Brown got 12% interest, and Hank Paulson only took 5%. Why couldn't he have done the same thing? Meanwhile, we're coming up on the end of the hour. Jay, we're going to get this transcribed, you think?
Oh, boy, I stepped into that one. Yeah, we'll do. I'll be happy to,
really,
Rob.
Helping.
Hey, I'll see you.
And, all right, thanks, Jay. Good to talk to you.
Okay, we'll be in touch.
This
Bye.
Is the Rob Call Show. It's 1360 AM, WNJC. We're affiliated with opednews.com. Opednews.com is a progressive media site, a community blog. Progressive means we're nonpartisan. We've got lots of people on.